Hello and welcome to a very special episode of The Laydown. My name is Ryan and today I am beyond excited to share an interview I did recently with Andy Weir. You may know Andy Weir from his incredible sci-fi novel, The Martian. In this interview, we discuss his latest novel, Project Hail Mary, which is out now. If you liked The Martian, you will love Project Hail Mary. I cannot recommend it highly enough. I loved it so much. There are some spoilers in this interview of things that happen about halfway through the novel. So if you want to be completely surprised by everything in the book, then go ahead and read Project Hail Mary first, and then listen to this interview as soon as you're done. But if you want to just jump into the interview and deal with the minor spoilers, you can do that too. Without further ado, please enjoy my chat with Andy Weir. So Andy Weir, how are you? How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the podcast. How's isolation going?
It is what it is. I mean, so I live with my wife and her mother. Her mother is very sweet. It's not like a TV show where, you know, or anything like that. I get along great with my mother-in-law, and her mother is elderly, so we're not taking any chances.
Yeah.
And in fact, just recently though, she finally got vaccinated.
Yay!
So yeah, she just got her second shot, I think like a couple of weeks ago. So she's about, I think it's like 2 weeks after the second shot. Yeah. So she's in good shape. My wife and I still have to be careful, but now we're not as nervous because, you know, we're both, I mean, we're not young, but we're not elderly. We don't have comorbidities. Mm-hmm. Our odds of actually dying if we got COVID are fairly low, but if we brought it back to her mom, that would be a much bigger deal. So I feel a lot better that her mom is vaccinated.
Ah, that's wonderful. Yeah. My in-laws just got vaccinated yesterday. They got the Johnson & Johnson one. So one and done.
Oh, the new,
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And what state are you in?
I'm in New Hampshire.
Okay. I'm in California.
So. Right on. A little warmer where you are.
a little bit. Yeah.
I'm a little jealous. It's supposed to get up to the 60s this week, and that feels like summer to me. So.
Yeah. Well, I used to live in New England. I used to live in Waltham, Massachusetts.
So, you know.
I had coworkers who would commute in from, that's when I was an engineer. I had coworkers who commuted in from New Hampshire.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah. Live in tax-free and then
yep.
Head down to Taxachusetts. Yep.
Yep.
Sounds about right. I was chuckling reading. I'm almost done with Project Hail Mary, which we'll get into in a bit. But I was chuckling reading it because I feel like your characters do fairly well in isolation. So like, I feel
That was just, I finished the book before COVID happened.
Yeah.
So, or rather not quite, like I finished the first draft in like January of 2020. And then we were doing like the real stay at home orders and like shutdowns and stuff happened right around the time we were done editing it. So it's not in any way deliberately topical. It just
ended happened
up
that
being
way.
That way.
Space, COVID, you know, one of the same.
But, you know, my whole shtick is an isolated genius, right?
Right. Yeah. No, I love it. It's great. I was Mark Watney would be doing great right now.
Yeah. Mark Watney is the social distance champion, right?
Yeah. We all just need to live like him. Just grow some potatoes on Mars. It's fine.
Yep.
I was
COVID
also
is 150 million miles away.
That's the ideal, right? I also, it was great. I discovered Cheshire Crossing.
Oh, yes.
This morning. Yeah. And I am the store's resident Alice in Wonderland fanatic. And I was like, how did I not know this was a thing? You people failed me. So I'm really excited to, I collect basically everything Alice. I collect different editions and adaptations and things. So I was like, no one told me about this.
So you haven't read it yet, though?
Not yet. I just grabbed it this morning.
I hope you enjoy it. Do you ever read, you know, Sarah Anderson?
Yeah, Sarah Scribbles.
Okay. Yeah. Sarah Scribbles. Yeah, she obviously, as you can see, did the art for that. So
that's so yeah. cool. I'm very excited to dive into that.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. I had a fun time writing it. I did my own art for it originally, and I'm a terrible artist. And then so after I made that before The Martian, before everything. And then after I became a Z-list celebrity, then they said like, oh, hey, let's take this comic you made, but get like a good artist. And then.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it was great.
I love that. So let's talk about the new book, Project Hail Mary. Okay. So for my listeners who have not yet had the privilege of reading it, because I have an advanced copy, give us the elevator pitch. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, a man wakes up from a coma in some sort of advanced hospital bed. He has no memory of who he is or why he's there. Over time, some memories start to come back, and he realizes he's aboard a spaceship and he's also on a critical mission to save all of humanity from extinction. So, you know, no pressure.
No pressure. I love this book. I am devouring it. Looking, I have like, I don't know, 20% left, and I was reading it and I got to a point where I realized, oh no, there hasn't been a disaster yet. And sure enough.
Oh no, I don't want to be predictable. No.
No, no. But I was like, oh, you know, it's really nice. Things are going really well.
Oh, I'm so glad things are going well. I'm sure it's going to be like that for the remaining 100 pages.
Oh no.
It's kind of like when you're watching a movie and everything seems to be buttoned up and taken care of, and you're like, an hour and 10 minutes in, and you're like,
Yeah. I was like, oh no, there's a lot of book left. but no,
well, I'm glad you're enjoying it, but you know, I'm sure you say that to all the authors. How often do you do a podcast and you're like, oh, I'm reading your book. It's it sucks.
I really hated your book. Press that or,
you know, this book, you know, it's top of my list for when I run out of toilet paper. Just saying.
I only do interviews with authors whose books I like.
Oh, okay. There we go. There we go.
No,
so
I'm
if I don't,
it.
So for my next book, if I don't get a request
you don't hear from me.
For your podcast, that's bad news.
That's how you'll know. You'll be like, that's oh man, you. Really disappointed Ryan on this one.
Oh dear.
Your books are so smart, right? They're so full of real science and your characters are so brilliant. Can you talk a little bit about sort of like the research that goes into it, the experts you talk to, things like that? Like how do you go about this very real, brilliant science?
Google. I mean, that's it pretty much. People think I have just this, you know, contact list full of all these like experts and NASA engineers and stuff. And I do actually, but Google's faster. I mean, and also Google means I'm not bothering people. You know, I'm not, hey, drop what you're doing and help me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot nicer just to look it up. Scientific information is very well documented. It's all over the place in the internet, and I can usually find what I need. Although for Project Hail Mary, there were some things where no matter how deep into the weeds I got, I couldn't find the answers I needed. So I did rely on a few folks. I thanked him in the acknowledgments at the end, but some of the fun ones are Dr. Jim Green, who is currently the chief scientist for NASA. But I first met him shortly after The Martian when he was the chief planetary scientist.
Oh, wow.
And so he's a planetary scientist, which was really handy because there's a lot of like planetary scale stuff going on here. Like how do atmospheres on exoplanets work, and how does this work and that work? And so it was great to be able to talk to Jim and just ask him those questions rather than try to understand scientific papers out there about it.
Yeah.
And another fun one is neutrinos play a role. It's not critical that the reader understand exactly how, but I wanted to be accurate. And It just so happens, this seems like the most bizarre coincidence ever, but going back in time many moons ago, all the way back to high school, it was a different time. It was the 80s. Michael Jackson was top of the charts, okay? And I'm in my high school physics class, and the guy who sat next to me is a guy named Chuck Duba, Charles Duba, Chuck. And he and I sat next to each other, and we weren't like buddies who hung out outside of class or outside of school, but we'd always goof off, there when we're in physics class, and we were always lab partners and stuff like that. Anyway, fast forward to the modern day, I'm me, an author who writes science fiction, and Chuck, Charles Duba, is now Dr. Charles Duba, a particle physicist who was part of the Nobel Prize-winning project that helped closely define what the mass of a neutrino is.
Oh my God, that's
So I I emailed Chuck and said, "I've got some questions about neutrinos, and I bet you know the answers." Like for Chuck, these were like extremely remedial questions,
I'm sure,
but it
yeah.
was really neat to talk to him about it and stuff like that. So that's just kind of a neat thing.
Oh, that's so cool. What a great coincidence. I love that. It's so funny reading your books as someone who I was terrible at science and math. Like I English major, right? And there's a reason I work in a bookstore and not, NASA. But I love the way that you're able to you don't even dumb it down, but your characters are so down to earth that the way that they think through the science just makes sense.
Well, that's yeah. Well, thank you. That's it can be a challenge, but I really enjoy that part of the writing. So I'm a very science-focused writer. That's my shtick, that's my thing. And so in order for that to work at all, for a story to work at all, I need the reader to understand the science. And I don't want it to read like a Wikipedia article. I mean, I love reading Wikipedia articles, but not everyone does, right? And so I have to, get that exposition across without boring the reader to tears. And so I've found this top secret weapon that no other author has ever discovered. Humor. That's it. Like, that's it. If you make them laugh while you're giving them information, they'll forgive you any amount of exposition. And obviously everyone knows this, but it works. And so I just need to find excuses for the subject to come up at all, then I can have snarky or funny conversations. And that works. Sometimes I do have to delve a little bit into, okay, why is this conversation happening at all? Like, why are two, physics experts talking to each other about stuff they both know? So I have to make sure one of them doesn't know something and so on. It always annoys me when I'm watching, something and two experts talk to each other about stuff that both of them know. So it's like, why are they having this conversation? It's like, imagine if the United States was a fiction. Like, imagine our entire world is a fictional story being written by an author. And I was like, and I'm like, the United States is fictional, and the author needs to like exposition stuff about it. And I'm like, hey, Ryan, as you know, we live in a representative democracy with a bicameral legislature. And in order for a law to get passed, it has to pass through both of those houses. I mean, as you know. And so, it's like, no, we both know this, so we don't have to talk about it. And it gets really annoying when that's happening in exposition. So I try to find reasons to have like the, I call it the little Timmy character, and in old educational shows, there's always a scientist and then there's his sidekick, little Timmy or whatever. And he's like, "Well, Timmy, the let me explain,
Yeah, like I can definitely think of a few examples where, because you have in Project Hail Mary, different scientists around the globe are all doing experiments. So there were a lot of great moments where it would be like, wait, you figured out what? Yeah. And then they could have that conversation.
Yeah, the way
the Russians figured out this cool thing.
the way I got away with the exposition is it's because it's like, not every scientist is an expert on everything, you know?
Right.
It's like, okay, here's this this Thai from Thailand scientist explaining, you know, how they made this medical breakthrough to a bunch of like, you know, to a biologist, you know, these are different things. And so, right. Yeah.
And then of course there's a character who has a very different everything.
Yes.
I think we have to talk about Rocky a little bit because I love him.
Okay. So, all right, let's talk about Rocky.
Let's start by talking about the Fermi paradox, right? Because
that I have an answer to that, by the way, but go on.
Please, by all means, I will throw it to you.
Well, so here we are. As you know, the Fermi paradox. Well, so I'll briefly explain the Fermi paradox because, well, you know it, not every single one of your listeners will.
Exactly.
Enrico Fermi said, why aren't we just inundated with aliens saying hi all the time? Because there's just so many stars out there, so many planets out there. If there's even the slightest chance that intelligent life happens, it should be all over the damn place. And we know there is at least a slightest chance because here we are. Enrico Fermi asked, like, why aren't we completely inundated with aliens? The smallest opportunity, the smallest probability of intelligent life happening on a planet times the total number of planets in our galaxy times the number of galaxies, there should be aliens everywhere. So why aren't we just inundated with that? Why haven't we found them, whether or not we want to? And so that's the so-called Fermi paradox. Like, why isn't this happening? And there are a lot of possible answers to it. And one of, I mean, ranging from, you know, metaphysical, ranging from religious to other things, like, you know, a religious answer would be like, God created the universe to make us. Mm-hmm. That's it. We're here. Didn't make anything else. I mean, that's a potentially, you know, religious answer. But my answer to the Fermi paradox is simple. It is this. It is absolutely categorically impossible to travel faster than light or to even send information faster than light. That's my solution. That there will never be any technology that enables neither travel nor even communication faster than light, that it cannot possibly happen. So there could be intelligent life that's like, you know, 100,000 years ahead of us technologically, and it's in the Andromeda galaxy. It would take 4 million years just for a signal from them to get to us. Mm-hmm. And it would take 4 million years from when we first started broadcasting before they could possibly even know we exist.
Right.
So that's my answer to the Fermi paradox, is space is big and the speed of light is slow.
I mean, I'm sold. Okay. Makes sense to me. It's so funny because, you know, I was reading up on the Fermi paradox last night in preparation. And then this morning I was listening to a different podcast called Jack of All Graves, which has nothing to do with space or science or anything, but they happened to be talking about the Fermi paradox. And I was like, what's going on?
OMFG.
It was crazy. But of course, in Project Hail Mary, we do meet an alien. We have some interstellar travel, and we meet the delightfully adorable dog-sized spider named Rocky.
Nicknamed Rocky.
Yes. We can't pronounce his real name.
Yeah. Yes, Rocky is an alien. The basic premise of the book is that our son has been infected by basically like a space algae. It's a mold kind of thing. It's just a single-celled organism that grows and lives on the surface of stars. And it also migrates to like wherever a nearby source of carbon dioxide, which it also needs. And stars don't have carbon dioxide. Disclaimer, stars have carbon and oxygen, but they're way, way deep down in the middle of the star that even astrophage can't survive in there. Mm-hmm. So they migrate, like a lot of life does, to a nearby planet where they can acquire carbon dioxide, then migrate back to the star. Okay. Also, these microcellular organisms can travel interstellar distances using that same means that they use for migrating, and that's how they spore like mold from star to star. There is no intelligence here. It literally is just mold. The problem is that it grows by doubling its population, double, and it becomes an issue because now the sun is starting to dim. It's absorbing enough energy is being absorbed from the sun that it is affecting the solar output, and it's just going to keep going worse. So eventually all life on Earth is going to die. So that's our problem. And then, but because astrophage, which is what they call this single-celled organism, which is Greek for a thing that, eater of stars. Astrophage is really, really good at collecting and storing energy and using it for propulsion in space. They use it to make an interstellar spaceship and to send someone to Tau Ceti. Why? Because they notice that all of the stars in our local area have this exact same problem. All of the stars are dimming, including our own, but not Tau Ceti, which is about 12 light years away. And they're like, why, which is very close in the grand scheme of things. And they say, like, why isn't Tau Ceti dimming? We're going to send some scientists to find out. And that's how our guy ended up in the situation. Well, Rocky is an alien from the, he's from the star that we call 40 Eridani, which is a real star. I'm not sure how far away it is from Earth. It's about 9 light years from Tau Ceti. I think it's something like 14 light years from Earth. Don't quote me on that. His planet, which is a real planet, a real exoplanet that we call, I think, 40 Eridani A dash. I don't quite know.
It's got a big scientific name.
it's got a name. And that is a real planet, by the way, that I just decided was adopted. His home world. And he's from there. Now they're having the same problem. Their star, 40 Eridani, is also dimming. It's also infected with astrophage. They also notice that all the local stars except Tau Ceti are dimming. So they also sent a ship to Tau Ceti. And Rocky and the main character, Ryland Grace, meet up in the Tau Ceti system by chance. And you might say, okay, a solar system is actually pretty big, right? It's very, very large. So how do two little ships happen to see each other? Well, they're both using astrophage as their propulsion system. And the way astrophage works is it uses light as propulsion. So it's an unbelievably huge amount of light being emitted by the engines of these ships. It's brighter than the star. It's in the infrared band, so we wouldn't be able to see it, but it's incredibly bright. You can't miss it. And so they meet each other, and after some fun first contact stuff, they communicate enough, they figure out how to communicate over time, and then they figure out they both got the same problem, and from that point on, they're working together. It's really a story about friendship.
It really is. Yeah.
That's what I was shooting for.
I adore Rocky. I just, when before they work out their entire communication system, and he says yes by doing jazz hands, and
jazz
I
hands.
Just like my whole, I was like, that's the cutest thing ever. I love the process of them figuring out communication. I have a toddler and a newborn. And so I am constantly teaching language. Right. And so I was like, oh, this is so cool to like, I was trying to think of like, would I be able to, you know, as I'm reading, I'm like, oh, would I be able to like teach a whole other being English? And I was like, oh wait, I am teaching a whole other being English. Like all
you
the
are
time.
Doing that.
I'm doing it all the time.
But your kid isn't starting out with like some other language.
No.
You don't have to learn his.
No, I don't. I love, how did you come up with the idea of having it be, so Rocky's language is musical chords.
Right.
Where did that come from? Was that just?
Well, it's similar to whale song, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So we have that in nature. And really our language is also musical chords, if you think about it.
Yeah.
It's just sound. Mm-hmm. And approaching Rocky's biology, I tried to work from the ground up. I said, like, okay, what do we know about his planet? I mean, he evolved. He's part of a species that naturally evolved on this planet. Mm-hmm. And that he's not just by himself. There's a whole biosphere on this planet. So how does that work? Okay. Right. And I also wanted, I'm so sick of science fiction where the aliens have a completely compatible, like, you know, biology with humans, or not, I don't mean compatible biology with humans, but with the human environment.
Yeah.
And Rocky, so it was important to me. Rocky would die very, very quickly in a human environment. He cannot survive in our air, in our pressure and stuff. And a human cannot survive in his. Iridians, he's from Eridani, so he's called an Iridian. Iridians live at like, what is it? Something like 29 atmospheres of pressure. Mm-hmm. So 29 times our atmospheric pressure at about 210 degrees Celsius, which is like, I don't know, like 400 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and an atmosphere of almost pure ammonia.
Yeah.
So like super duper deadly to a human. Meanwhile, because their atmosphere, they don't have free oxygen in their atmosphere and they're really hot. If they come into our atmosphere, like they will literally just catch fire because they have unoxidized material all over. And so it's extremely bad. And so they always have to have a wall between them and stuff like that when they're moving around. He makes like a hamster ball for them and stuff. But yeah. And so one of the reasons I kind of came up with, okay, what's his biosphere? I wanted it to be, you know, kind of unique, but also, I'm one of those guys that really, I just hate coincidences in stories. And one thing that bugged the hell out of me is I'm like, okay, this is kind of a neat story. And yeah, we're well into spoiler territory. Mm-hmm. Turns out Tau Ceti is where Astrophage is from. Mm-hmm. It naturally evolved in the Tau Ceti system.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay, so we have three stars. We have Sol, that's our star, and Tau Ceti and 40 Eridani. They're all very close to each other in the grand scheme of things. Like Tau Ceti is 12 light years away, 40 Eridani is, I don't know, it might be like 19. I don't know. It's very close. Mm-hmm. And then for reference, the Milky Way galaxy is about 100,000 light years across.
Yeah.
So this is like, you know,
a little pocket. Just,
yeah, exactly.
We're all very close together.
Exactly. Compared. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. So to give you an idea of how big a galaxy is, if you shrunk the Milky Way galaxy down to the size of the United States, our solar system would be about the size of a white blood cell.
Oh my God.
So that's like,
wow.
Size comparisons here. But anyway, what bugged me is having these three stars all right next to each other, just basically really, really close. All three of them happen to evolve life independently. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. that, I mean, life, if that's the case, I would basically be saying that the odds of life evolving in a solar system are basically one, you know,
right.
I mean, like that. I did not like that. And so I wanted life to still be really rare. So what I came up with was that astrophage is there's a reason I chose Tau Ceti. It's a very old star. Mm-hmm. It's much older than our star, older than 40 Eridani. So it's had life for a long time, long before there was life on Earth, long before there was life on Erid. And so my explanation was this concept of an interstellar monocellular life form has been around for a long time. So it was a panspermia event. Basically, life evolved originally. All the life in this story evolved originally at Tau Ceti, and it fanned out and spread out. And once in a while, it would happen to end up on a planet where it could kind of barely survive, and then leave it alone for a few billion years, and it specializes into that biosphere. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, it made things a lot easier for me too, because when they're analyzing astrophage, they're like, oh, it's a cell. Yeah. I mean, it has mitochondria and a nucleus and DNA and stuff like that. And Rocky's biology is also like that. Mm-hmm. Rocky's biology is also has mitochondria and DNA, and they use ATP for energy storage and so on. So it made things a lot easier for me that I didn't have to invent multiple completely different, you know, systems.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of fun with that. Anyway, Rocky communicates with whale song, with internal bladders that just move back and forth. Mm-hmm. I figure evolutionarily, I made a list of what does a species need to have in order to become spacefaring, in order to become an intelligent species that has a civilization that's capable of building spacecraft and stuff like that. Said, well, first off, you definitely need a pack instinct, right? You need to work together. You need cooperation. Humans, we do that. Yeah. And you can't do that if you're like bears or something where they don't communicate at all. Right. Second off, you need communication. You need language. You need a way to get information from one of your tribe to another. And I'm like, okay, well, communication could be lots of different things. It could be motion. It could be light. It could be this, that, or the other thing. But there, the biosphere I came up with for their homeworld is they have such a thick atmosphere that sunlight doesn't even reach the surface. Right. So they never evolved vision. They don't have eyes. And so I'm like, well, they're definitely going to need some way of knowing what their environment is. So they actually use like basically passive sonar and echolocation like bats. Mm-hmm. And, or even better than bats, they have passive sonar. They have an understanding of their 3D environment just based on ambient sound, mm-hmm. which sounds incredible until you realize we have an understanding of our 3D environment just based on ambient electromagnetic radiation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, at one point in the book, Rocky's talking to Ryland. He's like, let me get this straight. You can hear light.
Yeah. Amaze.
Yeah. Amaze. 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 Happy, happy, happy.
Happy, happy, happy.
So among other things, I decided since it's a pure ammonia, I didn't want free oxygen in their atmosphere. So I said they have to have an entirely internal balanced biosphere inside of his body. Mm-hmm. And so he gets energy by eating other creatures, carnivore, you know, apex predator of his planet like we are on ours. But that means that everything has to be balanced. And also I decided that his immune system, one of the main ways Iridian immune systems work is just by having a very strong barrier between the outside and the inside. And so they don't breathe, they don't respirate, they don't need to take oxygen from the atmosphere and get rid of carbon dioxide, but they have the same cellular mechanisms that we do. So they actually have a balanced ecosystem inside their body. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they have plant-like cells and animal-like cells that exist in balance. They need to bring energy into the system, so they need to eat, but that's it. And they excrete also, but that's it. And so with all that in mind, since they don't have lungs, since they're not breathing air, what they have instead are bladders of air inside that can push back and forth across kind of like vocal cords. Mm-hmm. And so they can go, so it's like whale song, and they have five of them because pentagonal symmetry comes up a lot in their biology. Yeah. They kind of have five of everything. They have five legs, they have five hearts, they have all this stuff. And so they have five of these bladders, and each one they can control individually. So they make chords.
Yeah.
So their communication is with notes of these five bladders. So it's like, oh, that's kind of like close to an E flat major or whatever. So they chime and
It's so cool. I'm really excited for when the audiobook comes out, because I want to hear how that's done.
There's been a lot of talk about that. I think what they're going to do is they're going to have like tones, like, you know, and they're going to make them sound kind of biological and stuff like that. There's also been a lot of talk about how to deal with it in the movie.
Yes. Let's talk about the movie.
Let's talk about the movie.
Oh my God. So
said Ryan Gosling.
It's Ryan Gosling is right. going to be Dr. Ryland Grace. How cool yep. is that?
It's very cool, especially since his initials match. It was a very nice.
It was meant to be.
Meant to be. And yeah, Ryan Gosling is going to be the lead. And so a lot of talk in the movie has been like, okay, in the book, it's basically just made clear over time that Ryland kind of memorizes, it just learns to speak Iridian or learns to understand it.
Yeah.
And Rocky, actually, Iridians have basically photographic memory. So it's much easier for Rocky, but he learns English or he learns he learns how to understand it. Right. Neither of them can make the sounds that the other one makes. Right. So neither of them, they just both speak their own language.
Yeah.
In the book, it's just made clear eventually that it's kind of like Star Wars, where everybody just, well, come on, that's not fair for you to say. Right. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And you can't really do that in this story because you need to know what Rocky's saying.
Right.
So, how do you do that in a visual medium, in a movie? Yeah. Right. And so what we were thinking of is Ryland just he writes a program that will translate into and it'll say it in English.
And it'll speak it. Yeah. Him. That makes sense.
It's like a translator. And we were thinking it might even be cool if it's like, you know, just like your sat nav system has like celebrity voices. He might choose a celebrity voice to be Rocky and we'll have that celebrity
that
do
would
the
be
voice
so great.
That'd be neat.
I love that would be fun.
and then the chiming and stuff would be in the background.
I love that. I'm so excited.
Well, you never know if a movie's gonna get made, so
right. I mean, we'll true yep. But it's got an IMDb page already. I checked.
It does. It has an IMDb page. MGM bought the rights. They're very excited about it. That's how it is in Hollywood. Everybody's very excited about everything, right?
Yeah.
So we'll see. And COVID obviously
slowed
everything down. We've got Drew Goddard working on the screenplay. He wrote the screenplay for The Martian.
Oh, awesome. That's cool.
Yeah. So.
Yay.
He did such a good adaptation of The Martian. I'm like, well, Drew's my first pick.
Yeah.
Can we get him?
Yeah.
And I called him up and he said, well, you know, I'm really busy. I'm working on this, that, and the other thing. And I'm like, okay. Then he read the book and he said like, yeah, I'll do it. So yeah. I guess he liked the book.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I'm in.
Yeah. So that's nice.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I The Martian is definitely one of those ones that when I talk to folks, I'm like, yeah, no, the adaptation's actually very close to the book. It's
close.
You can do both. It's fun. I just sort of thinking of The Martian for just a hot second. I have this regular customer who, I mean, she's been shopping here since she was like 11 and, reading at a much higher level than her age. And I remember for a while she wanted science fiction, but she wanted science. Like she wanted science-based science fiction. And I was so excited when The Martian came out and I was like, here. And she was like, this is exactly what I've been looking for. And I was like, I know.
Sweet, cool.
So,
for those listeners who are interested in having their kids read The Martian, but concerned about the massive amount of profanity in the book, there is a classroom friendly edition, which has all of the profanity replaced with PG alternatives. So
that's fun. And
there's no excuse not to share The Martian with your children.
No excuse. And in Project Hail Mary, there's no swearing.
There's
very, very, very little.
Yeah, the main character.
I guess that's swears. Yeah, the main character doesn't
once in the entire book.
Yeah,
at a very at a time where it's extremely appropriate.
Yeah.
And at no other time. And in fact, kind of comedically doesn't swear. He says things like "golly."
Yeah.
And shucks and stuff like that, because as we learned, he was originally a junior high school teacher, so he's just trained himself out of swearing ever.
I love that. I think it's one of the first things he wakes up and he says something like, oh, golly. And he's like, oh, golly.
Golly? It's like, why do I say golly?
Why do I say that?
Shucks.
Oh, heck.
Yeah, he never swears.
It's great. I love it.
And yeah, I admit there is a little bit of an inside joke where he's kind of the opposite of Mark Watney in that respect.
That's true. That is true. I hadn't quite put that together, but yeah, he's pretty polar opposite in that respect, at least. Yeah.
He's also a bit naive. Like he's a little bit,
isn't he? Yeah.
He's a bit of a Boy Scout. He's a little naive. He's not world weary. He's a fundamentally good person.
Yeah.
That's kind of one of his things, is he's a little too goody goody at times. And
he's very sweet.
He's a sweet man.
He's very sweet. Yeah. It sometimes takes him a little bit to catch up to what maybe is going on, but he's so smart. He's so smart.
He's real smart.
So, creative in his solutions. But I love that, there's one point where, he goes off, he's got to do some calculations and experiments, and he leaves. And he comes back and Rocky is so mad that he left. He's like, why did you leave? He's like, I did this really amazing experiment and I figured out this thing. And Rocky's like, I literally handed you the answer. You had waited 5 minutes.
Yeah. Rocky was mad because Rocky gave him the information he needed, but Grace misinterpreted it and then went and did all these experiments to figure out the answer. Rocky's like, yeah, or you could have just done this. Just
looked at this thing and it would have told you everything.
Done that.
You left. Bad. Bad, bad, bad.
Bad. Bad, bad, bad. Yeah, he repeats himself. He says something three times if it means emphasis.
Yes. And I love that he says question at the end of a question.
He always says question at the end.
It's just great. It's creative and adorable. And I love Rocky. I want my own Rocky.
People have really responded to that. It's funny when I write a book, I say okay, here's what I want the reader to feel. Here's what I want the reader to think. But there's also always unintended consequences of where I'll get, really positive feedback from readers in directions I never expected. And I didn't expect, everybody who reads the book just loves Rocky. They love him. They can't get enough of him. They're like, he's the greatest. I love Rocky. I didn't expect that. I wanted people to like Rocky. I wanted them to root for him. He's one of the the deuteragonist. He's like, go Rocky. I want him to win. But I didn't expect the love for Rocky. Yeah. It's like, wow. Okay. Yeah. I'll take it.
Yeah. I guess you wouldn't expect a dog-sized spider creature to be beloved.
Well, he's a very nice dog-sized spider creature. He's a sweetheart. He's also a dog-sized spider creature that weighs 800 pounds or something.
He's just a boulder with legs.
Well, his outside is oxidized minerals, so rock, hence Rocky, but also his blood is mercury.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, his blood is liquid mercury. All the parts of his body are real, real heavy things.
Yeah.
He's from a planet with gravity over 2 times Earth.
Oh my God.
Not only is he really heavy, he's also from a planet where the gravity is really high. So Rocky is strong. It comes up a couple of times where, I remember, I think there's a scene where the ship is going wildly out of control and bouncing around and stuff like that. And Grace is just getting thrown around the cabin and just like that. And Rocky's just hanging on casually. It doesn't even need to really work at it. He's just like, all right. Yeah.
He's just on the subway. It's just
no. Yeah, right. Exactly. For him, it's just not a big deal. Rocky is very strong.
Yes, he is. That must be so fun though, to write a book and then to see what sticks with people.
Yeah. It's I didn't expect it. I mean, back in the day when I wrote The Martian, I wrote it, you know, it was a labor of love that I wrote that I just posted to my website and self-published later. There's that whole story. Everybody knows that, or everybody who cares about my writing knows that. And what I never expected was, like, at the time I wrote it, I thought I was writing it for hardcore dorks. Like, I had a small following, like 3,000 people, hardcore nerds who just love math and science. And I'm like, I'm going to write a story for them. You know, I'm going to write, you know, all the math's going to be there. I'm going to actually lay it out, have it all explained and stuff like that. And I had no idea this would have any broad appeal. I'm like, who the hell wants to read a book which is basically 350 pages of algebra problems, right? Who wants to do that? Why does anyone want to do that other than this small group of nerds? But what I found out is they just loved Mark.
Yeah.
And I didn't go out of my way to make Mark Watney, like, I'm going to make this guy lovable. I'm going to make his personality carry the story. It was just, I'm like, I'll take it.
Yep.
I'll take it.
Yeah, it definitely is. Speaking as a bookseller who has hand sold it a lot, it definitely has a huge wide appeal. I feel like there are more people who I can hand this book to and say, yeah, I think you'd like this, than there are that I'd be like, no, not for you. There is a very small percentage that I'm like, no, maybe not for you.
Maybe not for you.
Yeah, no, it's, and I think this one even more so is going to have just like huge appeal.
I hope so. Oh, I always hope so.
I mean, yeah, we always hope so.
You're only as good as your most recent book.
That's true. Just talking on, you know, sci-fi and sci-fi books, what are some of your favorites? Do you have like influences, or do you just have like a core fave that you just can't get?
Well, you know, it's funny, and I'm like 98% suspect you would agree. If you ask me what my favorite book is every day for a week, you'll get different answers.
Yeah, 100%.
Right? It's just like my mood, you know, whatever.
It's like whatever I'm reading at the time.
Or just like right now, you know what? I have a great appreciation for iRobot, but tomorrow I'm about, you know, The Name of the Rose, you know, whatever. It's like, but my main influences are the juvenile sci-fi novels of the 50s and 60s. Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, Arthur C. Clarke, and lesser known but much beloved by me, Clifford Simak. And the reason is simply because those are the novels I grew up reading. Now, you might say, Andy, let me do some math on your age and those books, and you'll find that, like, you know. So these books were written in the 50s and 60s, and I was reading them in the 80s when I was a teen. A tween. And it's because it was my dad's science fiction book collection. So my dad had this, he was a nerd, is still a nerd. He's fine. And he had this huge collection of just, man's never thrown away a book in his life. And so like the things he read when he was young and just this infinite science fiction bookshelf that I would just, all right, reading this. All right. Next, reading this, next.
I love that.
And so I was reading these books that are like, they have the yellowed pages. Yeah. There's an advertisement for Kent cigarettes halfway through the book.
Yep.
Because, hey, 15-year-old boys are going to read this. We got to advertise cigarettes, you know?
Yeah, yep.
It was the 50s. That was the time. And so since I grew up reading those, that's kind of the style that I like. Now, some of them don't age well, especially when we're talking about gender and race stuff, but let's not get into that.
Yeah.
When reading those books, you just have to say, like, okay, this is a book from this time.
Yeah.
You know, and just say,
Yeah, you know, it's very firmly of its time.
This is of its time. You can't write that book now. Live with it. All right. But one thing, a core trait of those books that matters a lot to me was science fiction in that era was really positive and optimistic. It had this very positive view of the future. Now, the characters in the story would have life-threatening problems and they would have bad times and there were bad times in the world too, but it was always this notion of the future is awesome. Like, the future is awesome. You catch a spaceship, you go to Mars, and you have these adventures, and there's, you know, all this stuff, and there's It's just such a positive view of the future that I feel like has been lost in more contemporary sci-fi. So it's just, I like that optimism. So yeah. Those are my influences. My Holy Trinity, I guess. I do love Simak, but my Holy Trinity would be Asimov, Heinlein, and Clark. Mm-hmm. And of those three, my favorite book for each of them, I think Asimov, Caves of Steel. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love I, Robot, but Caves of Steel is the beginning of a long adventure of reading lots of books. That's fun. Nice. Heinlein, I really loved Tunnel in the Sky, which is not as well known as his other stuff, but it's a survival story. And it was, I do love those, you know, person versus nature. And then finally, for Clark, I loved Rama.
Nice.
Which is, you know, sort of first contact novel. It was also hard sci-fi. I'll just warn everybody listening, don't bother reading the rest of the Rama series. Just read the first one.
Just read that one.
And then you're done.
That's very valid. That is so valid. Is there anything that you've read recently that you want to just throw out and recommend to the listeners?
Sure. Okay, so in terms of recent reads, I highly recommend Recursion by Blake Crouch.
Yes.
It is very good. Mm-hmm. I really liked Recursion a lot. It was
that's a really good one.
Solid. Yeah.
That's a really good one.
Also, his previous one, Dark Matter.
Yeah.
Was also very good. Blake's just a good writer. What can I say? Great. And I guess he just writes the kind of sci-fi I like. So I've only read the first one, and so I'm like way out of date, but I like the COWAL books. The Calculating Stars is the first one, K-O-W-A-L. So wonderful. I read that and I liked that. I haven't read the later ones. Another one I liked a lot, dang it, and I keep remembering it by its original title, and that's not what it was called. It was called The Albuquerque Door, and it's by Peter Kleins, but that's not what it ended up being called. I think it might've been called The Fold.
Okay.
Yeah, The Fold is what it actually ended up being called. That was good. I liked that.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Andy, for chatting with me. This was fantastic.
Sure.
And I'm very excited for Project Hail Mary to come out on May 4th of this year.
May the 4th.
May the 4th, of course.
That was not...
not planned, but a happy coincidence. That.
Yeah, not planned, but yeah.
I love it. Well, awesome. Thank you so much. Best of luck in your virtual book tour and with the release and all that.
I'm here in this seat. This seat is my book tour. All right.
I love it. Thanks so much, Andy.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Thanks, you too. Thank you again to Andy Weir for chatting with me. Project Hail Mary is available now. You can email us about the podcast at thelaydownpodcast@gmail.com. Our website is gibsonsbookstore.com, and we're also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and we'll put those links in the show notes along with all of the books that were mentioned during this episode. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll know when we upload our next episode, and consider leaving us a nice review. Until next time, we'll see you in the stacks. Bye.